It's time for the Des Moines Register on this first day of February, Thursday. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and some from the USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and from donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, statewide today look for mild temperatures with times of clouds and sunshine. Winds north-northeast 4 to 8 miles per hour. Considerable cloudiness tonight with winds east 7 to 14 miles per hour. And the forecast through the weekend for central Iowa looks like this. Today and tonight, look for mild temperatures with clouds and sun. Winds north-northeast 4 to 8 miles per hour with considerable cloudiness tonight. A high of 56 today with a low of 35. On Friday, a shower in the afternoon with a high of 48 and low of 36. On Saturday, should be mild again with low clouds, a high of 51 and a low of 34. On Sunday, look for some brightening and mild temperatures, a high again of 50 and a low of 32. And looking at precipitation in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Wednesday, we'd have zero. Our month to date, and of course this would be through Wednesday, which was still January, so the month to date was 1.91 inches against a normal of 1.08 inches. And since that was the first month of the year, that was the same for the year to date. Last year on that date, we had had 1.64 inches. Snowfall in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Wednesday, again zero. Month to date, again looking at January, 27.2 inches. The normal month to date would have been 9.4 inches. And the season to date, 30 inches, with a normal season to date of 20.5 inches. Sunrise today was at 7:27 a.m. with sunset tonight at 5:30 p.m. No moonrise today, so no moon today, rise or set. And it has been warming up with warmer, milder temperatures in Iowa. Our extremes in Iowa ranged from a 59 high at Clarinda to a low of 18 in Mapleton yesterday. Not so nationally. In the 48 contiguous states, the high was registered at 81 degrees in Gila Bend, Arizona. But the low was in Presque Isle, Maine, and it was 20 below, so still cold in some places. So turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, here are the headlines. Perry High School reopening eerily normal as grief lingers. Gender identity proposal is killed. That would be in the legislature. And Mayorkas impeachment is growing closer. Now here with the first story is Linda.
I'll read the story about Perry High School. The subtitle, some parents say the school's new security measures aren't enough. Perry High School students headed through the front doors of the high school Wednesday without much fanfare. Just another day of classes in hallways forever changed by a school shooter who took the lives of a sixth grader and their principal nearly 4 weeks ago. Their entry felt eerily normal, though there were still signs of a grieving community determined to reclaim our school, as the school district puts it. At least one therapy dog, Sky, whom the district has hired to provide support to students and staff, entered with the students. Blue ribbons, Perry's school color, are still tied around light poles and on the victory bell near the front entrance. Red and blue cups spell out Perry Strong along the football field fence across from the high school, while Blue Jay Strong flashed on the sign outside Perry Middle School. Yuvia Vaca, a ninth grade student, said she was hesitant about coming back to school on Wednesday for the first day back since the shootings. It's just nerve-wracking, to be honest. I really don't want to walk through the hallways where everything happened. No, I can't do that, But here I am, she said, before she crossed the street and walked through the front doors. Police say Dylan Butler, a 17-year-old Perry High School student, shot and killed 11-year-old Amir Joliff, a student at the adjacent middle school, fatally wounded Perry High School principal Dan Marburger, and injured two other staff members and four students before taking his own life during the January 4th shootings. Since then, the district has worked to reopen the middle and elementary schools, which it did last week, and make repairs to the high school and put new safety measures in place before the first day of classes. And Tuesday night, the high school hosted its first home sporting event since January 4th, a wrestling meet that opened with a moving moment of silence involving Perry and Roland Story wrestlers, coaches, and fans. Still, some parents say they continue to have concerns as their children return to those halls. An online petition, which has 607 signatures as of Wednesday, asks for additional safety measures at the schools, including having only one secured entry point during school hours and installing metal detectors at that entrance, adding a temporary no-bag policy on school grounds, and ensuring police presence on site during operational hours. The security demands laid out in the petition were garnered from online community posts and from talking to two mothers whose children were injured during the shooting, said Miranda Cumming, a district parent. I just think it's our duty to provide the best security that we can, Cumming said. And that way we can say that we did everything in our power to prevent this horrible nightmare from ever happening again. Mark Drehos, a parent of one high school and two elementary students, said that parents have the right to ask more of our school. We have the right to speak up when it concerns our children's safety. I 100% support our school. I 100% support our school staff. I think they're amazing, he said. That being said, I do think that there should still be preventative measures and a reaction to this put in place greater than what has been so far. As part of the Perry School Board's reopening plan, the schools will not let anyone inside unsupervised until 7:30 a.m. at the middle and high school buildings and 7:45 a.m. for the elementary school. Students must also exit the buildings within 15 minutes after the final bell. Each school now has limited points of entry, and all will have increased adult and uniformed law enforcement presence and visibility for the time being. There were no plans announced to install metal detectors or make changes to the school's bag policies. The district is going to continue seeking out the expertise of law enforcement and other safety experts, board member Eddie Diaz said on January 19th. After law enforcement completes their investigation, further measures may be considered. Drehos said he would like to see the increased law enforcement presence continue through the end of the school year. Right now, it's just for the foreseeable future, he said. I think you need to draw a hard line to put people at ease and make them comfortable, because right now, I'm comfortable that there is a law enforcement presence at the schools. It's what made me be able to sleep at night, sending my kids back. But when they pull those, I'm going to have that uncomfortable feeling again. It's just too soon. Drehos said he also would like the district to hire another school resource officer so that there would be one at the elementary school and one at the middle high school building. The district currently has one school resource officer who patrols all three schools and their 1,800 students. I would just like to be able to know that if bad things happen, there's a trained officer on site that can intervene right away, Drejos said. I don't think that's too much to ask for, especially knowing that what we thought could never happen did happen. And while he isn't asking for metal detectors to be installed, Drejos would like to see a no-bag policy put in place until the end of the school year. Butler's social media in the minutes before the shooting showed a picture of him in the school bathroom with a large bag. The shooting happened at about 7:37 a.m. before school started. Other parents have said no safety measure is foolproof. I don't care if the school, they can put everything in place, they could put metal detectors and all that, but that's not going to keep anybody 100% safe, Kristen Durham said. This is going to be something that everybody is going to have to work through, because what else can you do? Durham's daughter is an eighth grade student at Perry Middle School. Durham and her husband brought their daughter to an open house the day before school started on January 25th. While Durham appreciated the additional law enforcement presence and how welcoming the staff was, her daughter was still hesitant about going back the next day. I thought that would kind of make my daughter feel a little bit better just because of how everyone was welcoming. But after we got home, she was like, I can't go back tomorrow, Durham said. She's having a really hard time going back. She's been not sleeping, having nightmares. Durham said her daughter planned to go back to school on Monday. The school district said 100% of the middle school teachers and 91% of middle school students were back in the classroom for their first day back. In the elementary building, 96% of teachers and 88% of students were back in the classroom for their second day back. I told her I want her to feel safe when she goes back, Durham said of her daughter. I don't want her to get to school and be so upset. She's not going to learn anything if she's that overwhelmed. While Durham knows that students need to get back to school to be with their friends, she said it will take time to heal. Making the school safer does not end at security, Cummings said. The district and community will need to address issues around bullying and helping people access mental health care services. Cummings is also working with school officials to have a discussion about security added to a future school board agenda. I know there's no single strategy or even a combination of strategies that will provide a 100% guarantee, Cummings said, but these measures may deter threats and make them think again. Drejos described himself as a proponent of getting students back in school, but said, I'm also just an advocate for putting some more safety measures in place, and I'm not even an extreme one on that. He owns the Lazy Goose Boba Tea and Ice Cream with his wife, Yvette, in Perry. The business, which is closed in the winter, popped open for a couple days after the shootings to offer free drinks for Perry students, staff, police officers, and first responders. Drejos said the students he talked to had no objection to having a police officer or metal detectors added in the building. They said at least we would feel safe. And isn't that kind of the most important thing? Drejos said. Let's get this year and this tragedy put behind us. Let's make these kids feel comfortable, and let's allow them to feel safe when they're in those halls. We owe it to them.
Gender identity proposal is killed. The bill would have erased civil rights protections. Iowans waved rainbow pride flags and erupted in cheers in the Iowa Capitol hallway Wednesday afternoon as lawmakers announced they were killing a bill that would have removed gender identity protections from the state's civil rights laws. All three members of an Iowa House subcommittee that considered House File 2082 Wednesday said they would not advance it to the full House Judiciary Committee for consideration. The bill would have removed gender identity protections from the Iowa Civil Rights Act and would have added gender dysphoria or, quote, any condition related to a gender identity disorder, end quote, to the definition of a disability that would be protected under the law. The Iowa Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination based on race, creed, color, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, religion, ancestry, disability, and gender identity. Lawmakers added the protections for gender identity in 2007 when Democrats held the Iowa legislature and governor's office. People who fall under one of the protected classes in the civil rights law are protected from discrimination in employment, wages, public accommodation, housing, education, and credit practices. LGBTQ rights groups cheered the bill's failure on Wednesday. We appreciate the lawmakers who stood against this discriminatory proposal, recognizing the inherent value of safeguarding transgender folks from discrimination in their daily lives, Courtney Reyes, executive director of One Iowa, said in a statement. The fight for equality continues, but today's outcome is a clear indication that the majority of Iowans stand against discrimination and believe in the protection of civil rights, Reyes' statement continued. Hundreds of LGBTQ Iowans and their allies packed the Capitol hallways to protest the bill, some draped in transgender flags or wearing purple shirts that said, "Don't legislate hate." Many lofted signs above their heads with slogans such as "I'm still human" and "Freedom belongs to all of us." Some who were listening to the live stream of the meeting shouted, "It's dead! It's dead!" as committee leaders announced that they would not advance the bill. Cheers erupted and the crowd broke into chants of "We will never go back." "I was a bit pessimistic coming in. I was," said May Caulfield, a 35-year-old Urbandale resident. "But this is good news," May said. Caulfield said this was her first protest and called the energy simply amazing. "I like being a protected citizen," she said of her decision to show up at the Capitol. "It's as simple as that, really," she added. In an emotional hour-long meeting, as Iowans testified to lawmakers about the bill's impact, chants of "trans rights are human rights" echoed off the marble walls and filled the room through the closed door. Elliot Sutton, a non-binary student at Ankeny High School, talked about being afraid of being denied housing, loans, or the right to shop in certain stores if the bill passed. "If this bill passes, I probably am not going to stay in Iowa because I don't want to live in a state that passes legislation that makes my life nearly impossible to live safely in our community," Sutton said. Amy Wichtendahl, a Hiawatha City Council member who is Iowa's first openly transgender elected official, told lawmakers that by considering the bill, they were entertaining making Iowa the first state in the country to repeal civil rights protections. "You seem to think that being trans is some kind of ideology, so I will say it plain," said Wichtendahl, who is running for the Iowa House as a Democrat. "There is no such thing as transgenderism. There is only transgender people. We are human beings. We are American citizens. We are Iowans. And we do not deserve this abuse that we are getting from our government," she said. Annie Sarcone, director of the Des Moines Queer Youth Resource Center, criticized the bill's categorization of gender dysphoria as a disability. "Gender dysphoria and being trans is not a disability. I'm not disabled," Sarcone said. "Shifting gender identity to a different code will actually make it harder to ensure protection, and quite frankly, it's disrespectful to people who have a disability who need that protection," she said. A few people spoke in favor of the bill at Wednesday's subcommittee. Geraldine Jones, a mother of two from Linn County, said she thinks the bill would give school boards and local governments clearer guidance when enacting future policies. She pointed to the Linn Mar School District's policy protecting transgender students that drew controversy. The school board was more afraid of being sued by a transgender student than securing the rights and protections of all students, Jones said. They chose to protect one student over another, she added. Iowa Republicans in recent years have passed a flurry of laws impacting transgender Iowans, including banning transgender youth under 18 from receiving gender-affirming medical care, restricting transgender students from using school bathrooms that align with their gender identity, and banning transgender women and girls from competing in female sports. House Majority Leader Matt Winchlett, a Republican of Missouri Valley, said the fact that the subcommittee chose not to advance the bill is a good indication that the ideas are not going to move through the committee process or receive a vote on the House floor. Winchlett said he does not believe the Iowa Civil Rights Act needs to be revisited. He said taking away protections that exist in the law could be looked at as an opportunity to discriminate against those protected classes. I would say I don't think that that would be a wise choice or the wise thing to do for those basic civil rights protections that are there, he said. Representative Jeff Shipley, a Republican of Birmingham, said who was the bill's author, called the subcommittee meeting the start of a conversation. There's a lot of interest in this topic, he told reporters following the subcommittee. There has been for a number of years. There are very relevant matters of law that need to be settled, and so this is a topic that's not going to go away, he added. Shipley said he believes those who oppose the bill and other legislation targeting transgender Iowans have created a retaliatory environment. He said he's received nasty messages that he called frankly unbecoming of people who want a society of law and order. As Shipley left the committee room, some members of the crowd raised their middle fingers and began chanting profanities at him. This behavior is being encouraged, Shipley said. They want to bully people into submission, and it's working on a lot of Republican lawmakers. They're too afraid of the mob, and that's unfortunate, he said.
Mayorkas impeachment growing closer. Breach of public trust among accusations made by House Republicans. House Republicans are taking their final steps toward impeaching Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, setting up a formal vote targeting a cabinet secretary for the first time in almost 150 years. The GOP-led House Homeland Security Committee, in a fiery hearing on Tuesday, approved two articles of impeachment against Mayorkas. They accuse him of a willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and a breach of public trust over his handling of the nation's southern border. But why exactly do Republicans want to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary? How have Mayorkas and his allies responded? House Republicans have long sought to impeach Mayorkas over the U.S.-Mexico border and his management of the policies surrounding undocumented immigrants in the U.S. GOP lawmakers have argued the secretary has deliberately allowed the status quo to continue and failed to use his role to take action. We have not approached this process lightly. Secretary Mayorkas's actions have forced our hand. We cannot allow this border crisis to continue, Representative Mark Green, Republican of Tennessee, chair of the committee, said in his opening statement on Tuesday, contending that Mayorkas has willfully declined to enforce existing immigration laws to address the border. White House Republicans have accused Mayorkas of not acting on the immigration laws the nation already has in place. They're also in eyeing new border policy. GOP lawmakers in the House passed a sweeping hardline border plan, known as H.R. 2, last year. The legislation would clear the way to build more of a border wall and set new restrictions for asylum seekers. However, that bill, which passed along party lines, has all but died in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Hours before the hearing, Mayorkas sent a letter to the committee pushing back against Green's claims. He argued his department has provided Congress and your committee hours of testimony, thousands of documents, hundreds of briefings. Undoubtedly, we have policy disagreements on the historically divisive issue of immigration. That has been the case between administrations and members of Congress for much longer than the past 83 years since the last overhaul of our immigration system, Mayorkas said in the letter. He noted that bipartisan discussions on border policy and immigration reform are ongoing in the Senate, which Mayorkas has been partly involved in recent months. Democrats have also criticized Republicans for pursuing impeachment against the secretary over what they say are simply policy differences, not any high crimes or misdemeanors. Neither of the impeachment charges the committee will consider today are a high crime or misdemeanor, Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, told his fellow lawmakers during the Tuesday hearing, referencing the standard for impeachment laid out in the Constitution. No serious person believes that they are. And the White House and Department of Homeland Security have often said they lack the proper resources and funding to properly enforce the law, putting the ball in Congress's court. The House's Republican leaders are currently shoring up support for a formal vote to impeach Mayorkas. Republicans have a razor-thin majority in the lower chamber, so they can't afford to lose the GOP lawmakers holding out on publicly backing the impeachment effort. Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, a key vulnerable member who was previously undecided on impeaching the secretary, told reporters on Monday evening he now supports the efforts in a good sign for leadership. But remember, if the House votes to impeach an official, that doesn't mean that they'll immediately be removed from office. If the lower chamber does vote to impeach a president, cabinet secretary, or other official, that push then goes to the Senate for a trial. Senators can ultimately vote on whether they want to remove an individual from their post. But in Mayorkas's case, even if the articles of impeachment clear the House, it is extremely unlikely he will be convicted in a trial in the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats.
And that concludes the stories from the front page of the Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. The lead story here is headlined Modified Education Bill Okayed by Senate Panel. And this is accompanied by a couple of interesting pictures. The first is of a Senate hearing committee in the state capitol, and it shows a large table at the in the middle with senators and people who are testifying gathered around the table, but it also shows a packed Senate hearing room with standing room only. So this was a very popular hearing. There's also a picture of a person who testified before the Senate panel. She's not identified, but she's wearing a T-shirt that says, I heart my AEA, which means, of course, I love my area education agency. Here's the story. Governor Kim Reynolds' bill to overhaul the state's area education agencies got a divided response among lawmakers Wednesday, with the House of Representatives with House Republicans balking at the proposal and GOP senators cautiously advancing it after testimony from dozens of teachers, administrators, and parents. Representative Schuyler Wheeler, a Republican from Hull, told reporters after a subcommittee hearing that he and others would have further discussions about the bill. Days after Reynolds released an amended version in response to initial concerns from legislators and advocates. A short time later, in the Senate subcommittee, a 2-1 vote advanced its version of the bill, with Chair Senator Lynn Evans, of a Republican of Orillia, expressing a desire to make changes. I'm not fully convinced that the bill that's in front of us, nor the amendments, truly get at the heart of the matter, said Evans, a former superintendent. At the beginning of the Senate hearing, as he explained the amended bill to the room, Evans reached over and tossed a printed copy of the first version in the trash can. That's probably the appropriate place for the original, Evans said. Democrats in both committees were staunchly opposed to the bill, with Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat of Cedar Rapids, saying, "No Iowan asked for this bill." "We cannot lose those services," Donahue, who is a special education teacher, said. "They would hurt my students. They'll hurt all students," she added. The proposal's frosty reception among some legislators signals another hurdle for one of the governor's defining priorities of the 2024 session. In a statement Wednesday afternoon, Reynolds thanked the Senate subcommittee for advancing the bill. She did not mention the House subcommittee. The amendment reflects feedback from legislators, parents, teachers, and school superintendents, ensuring that AEAs can continue offering the services they do today, Reynolds said. Iowa's 9 area education agencies provide special education services to schools across Iowa. The agencies, known as AEAs, offer general education services as well, such as professional training for teachers and free digital resources and media services like graphic design and printing. Under current law, school districts are automatically partnered with the AEAs and divert their federal and state special education funds toward the agencies. A portion of the AEA's funding also comes through property taxes. Reynolds' bill would allow school districts to choose whether to contract with their local AEA for special education and other services, or to discontinue their use of the AEA, instead seeking an alternative provider for special education, professional training, or whatever else they need that year. It would also raise the minimum salary for first-year teachers in Iowa to $50,000 per year, up from $35,500 under current law. Teachers with at least 12 years of experience would receive a minimum salary of $62,000. Parents, teachers, administrators, school board members, and advocates crowded into hearing rooms Wednesday to lend their input to the proposal. Those who came to oppose the bill argued that the agencies, long embedded within Iowa's education system, were vital for providing services and collaboration across specialties that require training. Carolyn Wozni, a speech pathologist at Grant Wood AEA, praised the agency's superb facilities and said that its high qualified and specialized staff were valuable for students with disabilities. "Please do not jeopardize this enormous asset, Wozni said. "Passing this bill would be catastrophic for students, school districts, teachers, families, students, and AEA employees," she added. Several superintendents, as well as the Iowa State Education Association and disability advocacy groups, testified against the proposal. So, too, did several parents and students who argued they could not have advanced through schooling without their AEA staff and tools. "It's very difficult to serve my son," said Suzanne Castello of Grinnell, who said he had multiple disabilities and had been pulled out for 4 years of homeschooling. "The AEAs help that. They help try to figure out how those teachers can do that," she said. Multiple other district leaders said they supported the bill, arguing that their schools would be better served if the money allocated to AEAs was instead granted directly to districts who can employ staff and services at their discretion. "My belief is that schools should be able to control flow-through dollars," said Corey Seymour, superintendent for Clear Creek Amana Community School District. "We have to continue to evolve to support the needs of our school communities. Each district is different," Seymour added. The Todd Abrahamson, superintendent for Okoboji Community School District, pleaded with other district leaders to step forward and make public concerns that he says have been voiced privately. Silence is support, Abrahamson said. Several other organizations, including Iowans for Tax Relief and Americans for Prosperity, expressed support for the Reynolds bill. Reynolds, speaking to reporters Wednesday morning ahead of the hearings on the bill, defended her proposal as necessary to hold to account agencies that she says do not receive enough oversight. You can't police yourself, get all the money, mandate that I use you, and not be held accountable when the scores are not reflecting what they should be, Reynolds said. That is unconscionable, she added. She expressed frustration at exact costs of AEA services being uncertain and pushed back when asked whether the timeline laid out under the plan gave districts enough time to decide whether to continue their AEA contract or seek another avenue. Well, they've been failing our students with disabilities for 20 years, Reynolds said. How in good faith can we say, let's just kick it down the road? They'll be okay for another 3 years, no big deal. Let's do a study. We know what the results are. For 20 years, we've known what the results are, she said. Reynolds said characterizations that the bill could unduly burden rural districts were what she called absolutely false, while asserting that many schools will retain at least partial contracting with their AEA. I don't think they'll see a lot of districts completely pull out. You'll see some, maybe some of your largest schools, she said.
City, police justified in youth's death, seeks dismissal of wrongful death suit. Des Moines police were clearly justified in shooting and killing a 16-year-old boy in 2022, attorneys for the city say in a motion seeking to dismiss a lawsuit over his death. Monica Woods, the mother of Trevante Jenkins, has sued the city for wrongful death, alleging he never pointed his gun at officers, as they claimed, before he was killed in a hail of bullets in the early morning hours of December 26th. The Iowa Attorney General's office had previously reviewed the shooting and found the officers acted with legal justification. In their motion, first reported by KCCI, city attorneys say that even based on the facts alleged in Wood's complaint, the officers cannot be found liable. According to the Attorney General's investigation, a relative of Jenkins called police to report he had pointed a gun at them. Arriving at the Southside apartment complex where the incident was reported, the officers, including Thomas Garcia, Noah Bollinger, and Zachary Deutscher, encountered Jenkins in an apartment and, together with relatives of the teen, repeatedly pleaded with him to put down the gun he was holding. According to a police account, Jenkins, whose brother had recently been shot and killed in Arizona, told officers he wanted to die and be with his brother. He eventually began raising his gun toward the officers. According to the Attorney General's findings, they opened fire, hitting him 14 times. In Wood's complaint, her attorneys, citing what they later said was police body cam video, deny that Jenkins's gun was aimed at the officers and say his finger was not on the trigger, and that he was not even looking in the officer's direction when they opened fire. Wood's suit further accuses the officers of needlessly turning up the pressure by backing Jenkins into a corner, shining lights in his eyes, and shouting at him rather than trying to de-escalate the encounter. The city's motion focuses on the officer's defense of qualified immunity, which holds police cannot be liable, even if they violate someone's rights, unless it was clearly established at the time that their actions were wrong. In this case, the city says, there was no violation of Jenkins' rights and no prior case law suggesting the officers acted wrongly. While a motion to dismiss a case at this early stage treats the allegations in the complaint as true, the city says it should win in court even if all of Wood's allegations are accurate. The plaintiffs admit that Jenkins raised the gun while surrounded by law enforcement, city attorneys write, adding that even if Jenkins wasn't looking at them or touching the trigger, the officers were not required to wait until a gun was pointed right at them before they fired their guns. For these reasons, the officers did not commit a constitutional wrong in their use of deadly force under these circumstances. Even if a court could find otherwise, the city says, prior courts that have considered similar situations have found that whether a suspect's finger is on the trigger of a gun is irrelevant to whether they pose an imminent threat. Accordingly, the officers should be granted qualified immunity and the case dismissed, the city argues. An attorney representing Woods could not be immediately reached for comment.
Benton honors fired board members. 3 months after the Benton County Board of Supervisors fired all members of the county's Board of Health without explanation, the county has a new Board of Health, ending a sometimes bizarre saga in the eastern Iowa county. On Tuesday, the Board of Supervisors appointed 5 new members of the county's health board, enabling the county to again receive state funding and to make decisions on the county's health structure. The county's top elected officials opted to appoint 5 new members to the board rather than reappoint the former members who had requested their seats back after being terminated this past October. Instead, the 5 former members of the Benton County Board of Health received commemorative plaques thanking them for their service to the county during Tuesday's Board of Supervisors meeting. The county's top elected officials also acknowledged wrongdoing in the termination of the former Board of Health in a public statement issued last week, stating the original reason for the board members' firings was what the statement called not correct. The process that resulted in the termination of the Board of Health caused confusion in the community and sent mixed signals about the dedication and service of the members of the Board of Health. We regret that, the statement said. Dr. Maggie Mangold, the former chairperson of the Benton County Board of Health, said the acknowledgement of their service is appreciated, but she would have liked to have seen what she called a true apology from the Board of Supervisors. It's bittersweet, she told the Register. I enjoyed my time on the board, and I'm very proud of what we did and what we accomplished, but I'm just sad. I'm sad for the county that they're losing a dedicated and knowledgeable board without reason. In October, the Benton County Board of Supervisors issued termination letters to all 5 members of the Benton County Board of Health without warning. The supervisor's letter said the reason was, quote, to reverse the 130% increase in the budget implemented by the Benton County Board of Health, end quote, referencing a proposed budget amendment from the Board of Health to hire an additional full-time public health staff member. The Board of Supervisors had approved the public health budget amendment on the same day termination notices were sent to the former members of the Board of Health. The supervisors have offered no explanation on why terminating the board was necessary to reverse the approved budget amendment, which is still in effect on the county's current budget for this fiscal year. However, the Board of Supervisors said their statement last week that the supposed 130% budget increase was incorrect. Quoting now from the statement, unfortunately, the number we initially reported was not correct and most of the budget increase was covered by state grants, the statement said. The actual additional cost to the taxpayers of Benton County was appreciably less than the numbers provided to us. That's the end of the quote from the state. Mangold expressed frustration this week that the former Board of Health members still have not been offered a clear reason why they were terminated without cause. We've still never been provided a reason, she said. I'd just like to understand why, she added. Supervisors Gary Bierchenk and Tracy Seaman declined to comment on the statement. Supervisor Rick Primmer, the chairman of the board, did not return a phone call requesting comment. However, Seaman said he's hesitant to support the hiring of a second full-time public health staff member if the new Board of Health moves forward with that proposal. The original Board of Health had proposed hiring a second staff member to help fill the gaps when the sole county public health employee was out of the office. When that person is not there, who fills in on the weekend and at night? We didn't feel hiring another person solves the problem, Seaman said. Instead, he said he hopes new members of the Board of Health would help fill in those gaps. However, filling in for the County Public Health Department is not a requirement of Board of Health membership. The Board of Supervisors' admission of a mistake, along with the thanks for the former Board of Health services, has been a stipulation of a settlement agreement reached earlier this month in the lawsuit filed by the former Board of Health, alleging that they had been illegally terminated from their positions. In that settlement, the Board of Supervisors did not admit to any wrongdoing. However, Benton County is responsible for paying for the Board of Health members' attorneys' fees. In addition, the Board of Supervisors must participate in training on Chapter 21 of Iowa Code, Iowa's law on public open meetings for governing bodies. In their statement, the supervisors said that they, quote, pledge to implement appropriate processes and annual training to ensure that all meetings are conducted in accordance with the law. That's the end of the quote from the statement. The Board of Supervisors declined to elaborate on what that training would entail. However, Seaman said he hopes the board would conduct less business in closed session. The vote to terminate the former Benton County Board of Health had been conducted during a closed session and had not been on the supervisors' public agenda. The Benton County Board of Supervisors could still face discipline from the Iowa Public Information Board, which has received several complaints regarding the supervisors' frequent use of closed sessions to discuss important matters. The state board is set to discuss those complaints at its February meeting.
Of eminent domain. Iowa House lawmakers are deliberating on a bill that would give the legislature the power to intervene to halt eminent domain proceedings in the state, a response to ongoing disputes around the construction of carbon capture pipelines. A three-member House subcommittee voted to advance House Study Bill 608 on Wednesday. At any time during the eminent domain process, the bill would allow 21 members of the Iowa House or 11 Iowa senators to file a petition to halt the process, stopping all associated hearings, trials, or other proceedings. It would take a vote of at least 60% of the House and 60% of the Senate to resume the eminent domain proceeding. The eminent domain process could also continue if 60% of each chamber sign a letter attesting that they believe the use of eminent domain is constitutional in that case. I think it's important that elected people, not appointed people, make this decision, said Representative Charlie Thompson, Republican of Charles City. Because if we get it wrong, we answer to the voters, and they can throw us out. Right now, the decision-making is being done by unelected people. The bill would also allow a company seeking eminent domain or a landowner who would be subjected to eminent domain to ask a court to review whether eminent domain is proper. Several landowners who would be affected by the pipeline proposed by Summit Carbon Solutions spoke Wednesday morning at the House subcommittee meeting, complaining about the process followed by the Iowa Utilities Board in holding a hearing last fall on the company's request for eminent domain. We need oversight, said Jess Mazur with the Iowa Sierra Club. We need somebody to be able to step in and pause the proceeding, and that's what this bill does. Summit is proposing a $5.5 billion pipeline that would capture carbon dioxide emissions from ethanol plants in 5 states, liquefy it under pressure, and transport it by a pipeline to North Dakota to be sequestered underground. Iowa regulators are considering Summit's request for a permit to build the hazardous liquid pipeline after holding a hearing in Fort Dodge for 8 weeks. Along with a permit, Summit seeks eminent domain powers, which would force unwilling landowners to sell them access to their property for the pipeline. Summit has pushed back its timeline for the pipeline, citing regulatory difficulties in several states, saying it doesn't expect it to become operational until 2026, 2 years later than initially projected. Thompson said he believes the pipeline's proponents have manipulated the current process of seeking eminent domain through the Iowa Utilities Board in their favor. "This is not about eliminating eminent domain," Thompson said. "This is about putting some due process safeguards on it and making sure that the due process that is in place is responsive to the people." Sabrina Zenor, a spokesperson for Summit, said 3/4 of the landowners along the pipeline's route have reached agreements with the company. Summit Carbon Solutions will ensure the long-term viability of the ethanol industry and boost land values and commodity prices, Zenor said in a statement. The issue of carbon capture pipelines have split Republicans who control the Iowa House and Senate. Ethanol producers and the pipeline supporters have said capturing and sequestering carbon emissions is a way for the industry to remain viable amid efforts to limit global warming. Opponents have criticized the use of eminent domain for the projects and raised concerns about the pipeline's safety. House lawmakers passed a bill last year that would have required companies seeking to build carbon capture pipelines to reach voluntary agreements to buy 90% of the land on their proposed route before they could ask the state for the ability to use eminent domain. The Senate did not give the bill a hearing. Representative Stephen Holt, Republican of Denison, who led the passage of that bill in the House, said he was extremely disappointed the bill did not move forward in the Senate. "I have no objection to this pipeline," Holt said. "I have objection to the use of eminent domain for this pipeline. I have objection to these companies using the heavy hand of government to try to seize the private property of landowners in my district for what is clearly a private economic development project that does not meet the constitutional bar requirement for public use." Holt, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, said he doesn't know how this year's bill will fare in the Iowa Senate. "I have no idea if anything's changed over there," he said. "I can only control what I can control. So we're going to do our best to do the right thing over here and let the chips fall where they may." Another company, Navigator CO2 Ventures, announced in October that it was dropping its own plans to build a carbon pipeline.
And that wraps up the Metro and Iowa section of the paper. We'll return now to the front page section with this story. Iowa lawmakers advance a contentious religious freedom bills. Iowa Republicans are again seeking to pass what are called Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. They say would protect Iowans' right to exercise their religion, but opponents say is enabling discrimination. The legislation would say that the government shall not, quote, substantially burden, end quote, someone's exercise of religion unless it is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and the least restrictive means of pursuing that interest. A person whose exercise of religion has been burdened would have the power to go to court to seek damages or other means of redressing the harm against them. The bill defines exercise of religion as action substantially motivated by one's sincerely held religious belief, whether or not the exercise is compulsory or central to a larger system of religious belief. That's the end of the quote from the proposed bill. I think Iowans should be free to live and work according to their faith without fear of being unjustly punished by their government, says Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican of Denison. This legislation guarantees that everyone gets a fair day in court when the government intrudes on their basic freedoms. It does not pick winners or losers, he said. Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat of Dubuque and a Presbyterian pastor, said the bill is, quote, all politics. What this bill does is weaponizes religious beliefs to justify discrimination, she said. I want to say that again. It weaponizes religious beliefs to justify discrimination and put Iowans in harm's way, added James. Republicans in the Iowa legislature have introduced a similar proposal almost every year since they took full control of the House, Senate, and governor's office in 2016. But the legislation has failed to advance in previous years. The Iowa House and Senate have introduced two identical bills this year, House Study Bill 614 and Senate File 2095. Both bills advanced through subcommittees Tuesday, and the Senate State Government Committee is set to consider its version on Wednesday. Opposition from business groups has been a key factor in stopping similar bills in the past. Several representatives of business groups again spoke against the legislation Tuesday at subcommittee hearings in the Iowa House and Senate. This bill would enable discrimination, said Tim Kuhn, a lobbyist for Principal Financial, which opposes the bill. It would empower Iowa business owners to deny services or accommodation based on a potential community or any other protected class. While termed religious freedom, we believe that such discrimination in any context is contrary to our state's values and sends the wrong message about Iowa, said Kuhn. Heather Schott owns a consulting business in West Des Moines. Schott, who is gender nonconforming, said she's concerned the law would present barriers to her growing her consulting business if landlords were able to refuse to rent space to her or potential clients refused to hire her. When my business does grow and I want to be able to move it into a public space, I see limitations for me in being able to do that, she said. Several Iowans who spoke to lawmakers Tuesday said the state and federal constitutions and the Iowa Civil Rights Act already protect the freedom of religion. Becky Taylor, executive director of Iowa Safe Schools, said the bills have the potential to open the floodgates to legal chaos and frivolous lawsuits at the expense of taxpayers. These bills are yet another element of the sustained attack on LGBTQ people in Iowa, she said in a statement. Representative Skylar Wheeler, a Republican of Hull, said he is not convinced the bill would result in economic harm to Iowa, pointing to other states that have enacted conservative policies while experiencing economic growth in recent years. The business community coming and telling us that this is going to hurt us is not true, Wheeler said. The business community coming and telling us that this is going to hurt us is not true, Wheeler said. It has not been happening anywhere else, he added. Tom Chapman, executive director of the Iowa Catholic Conference, said the bill gives everyone a fair hearing in court. This bill protects people of all faiths, he said. This is especially true for minority religions whose traditions are not always part of our mainstream culture. Jeff Pitts, a lobbyist for the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, said his group also supports the bill. This bill protects honest, earnest religious people and religious minorities, he said. This year, House Republicans have also set to consider a bill that would remove protections against discrimination for transgender people from the Iowa Civil Rights Act by removing gender identity as one of the protected classes covered by the law. That bill has a subcommittee hearing on Wednesday at noon, and we've already told you about that in a story earlier.